Okay, I think we'll begin because we have a competing event next door that begins at 10 o'clock that's going to get a bit noisy, and so we want to leave as much time for questioning as possible. My name is Joel Barkin. I'm a senior associate here with the Africa Program at CSIS, and this particular event today is the first of a series that we're going to be running over the next year on issues of governance security in Eastern Africa. And before we turn to today's guest, I'd like to ask Jennifer Cook to tell you a little bit more about this, because there's also going to be another event this afternoon about this, particularly with the support from the Ford Foundation, which enabled our first guest to come today. I think the introduction need not be long for Peter and Yang and Yongo. It's a special pleasure to welcome him in here to CSIS and introduce him as an old friend back in academic days and even student days. Dr. Nyong'o received his PhD in political science from the University of Chicago in 1977. He then began one might call a conventional economic academic career. But it wasn't conventional for very long at the University of Nairobi. He was outspoken about the injustices of the Moi regime. It got him jailed at several occasions. He left the country. He was in Mexico for a number of years, in Ethiopia, but eventually returned when the Kenya made the torturous transition to multi-party politics in the early 90s. He was elected to the Kenya National Assembly for the first time in 1992 and has been a member of parliament ever since. When the NARC coalition came to power in 2002, Dr. Nyong'o became the Minister for National Planning and did yeoman service in that position until the cabinet broke up after the constitutional referendum in November of 2005. Since then, as many of you know, he has been a pillar member of the Orange Democratic Movement. One might argue it's intellectual brains. He's the Secretary General of the party. He has been intimately involved in the negotiations and in the events that you're all familiar with that have unfolded over the last 2 months. So it's particularly timely that he's here, and I'm going to turn over the floor to you without further ado, and then we'll have an extension of extensive period for questioning.
Thank you very much, Joel.
One thing, could you turn off your cell phone? You heard mine go off, but better early than in the middle.
Thank you very much, Joel and Jennifer, for inviting me over to the CSIS. I'm very happy to be here and to meet old friends, old students like my friend over there, John Mula. John was my first graduate student actually at University of Nairobi. And then he left. I've been here ever since. I see Mark Bellamy here, our ambassador to Nairobi. So many people, so I'm happy to at least get this occasion to meet old friends and colleagues. But secondly, I intended really to do a good job today. So I compiled a very good document, which I thought I would pass around. But yesterday at Penn Station in New York, as I was talking on my mobile to my daughter, some liberated my bag and with all my things. But apart from the papers, they were not really very useful things. But Peter Gakunu here and Beldina were good enough to take me to, what do you call that thing? Kmart or something like that. almost close to midnight. So if you see me dressed reasonably well, it was thanks to the textile industry in this country. But I called Nairobi last night and got my colleague who is with us in the Pentagon, one of our research people. He was just coming out of the Prime Minister's dinner party, but he promised would email a copy which we can download after this, and I hope can be passed around. Joel asked me to come and give a talk on the Kenyan situation, which is a really mammoth problem. Let's begin in the following manner. Lots of you, I'm sure, have kept abreast on what has been going on in Kenya. But I just want to maybe make a summary of recent events and then go back a little to try and see why things happened the way they did. Because many people were shocked that Kenya, which had been a beacon of peace, stability, and all those good things you people talk about, all of a sudden went back to Hobbesian times. And it was quite shocking. And immediately, there was quick action in all fronts to make sure that, as it were, normalcy is restored. And this we can begin by looking at the Annan agenda, the negotiations at Serena Hotel, which brought back some amount of stability. And I underline that, some amount of stability. Well, that's very important because it is itself problematic. The Annan agenda had four key elements. And these key elements perhaps summarize in a very succinct manner the Kenyan problematic. One, the need to halt violence, restore peace, and freedoms. And that was done by all parties agreeing that we go out, preach to people, restore peace, and you can now, after that was done, drive from Kileleshwa to Lang'ata without fearing that somebody will top you on the way. Or you could take a bus from Nairobi to Busia and not get your head chopped off. It was very important that kind of normalcy be restored. So life goes on as it were as normal. But as you can see over the last few days, that has now been put to question. The second thing was to address the humanitarian crisis and promote reconciliation, which was done with people who were in police stations, particularly in the central province, being evacuated, going and joining families and so on. But the internally displaced persons are still there. And Professor Saitoti and myself chair a committee which started working even before the swearing-in of the ministers on emergency response to the crisis, which came out with a brown paper, not a blue paper or a white paper, on what needs to be done by government in conjunction with development partners to deal with this humanitarian crisis. The third thing was to form a grand coalition government, which would take care of the country for at least 2 years and make sure that it addresses these issues properly and puts the country on the road to democratic governance. But in order to do that, there was the fourth issue, the issue of fundamental institution reforms, which was seen as both a medium-term and a long-term agenda. Fundamental institution reforms, first instance of constitutional reform, which has been in the works for the last 20 years, as far as I remember, one of the reasons why some of us went into politics. And within constitutional reforms, other issues like judicial independence, parliamentary oversight authority, electoral reforms, and land reform. If you remember well, one of the major planks in the Bomas draft constitution was a new policy and approach to the land problem in Kenya. But since the Bomas draft never saw the light of day, the problem of land has continued to haunt us. And indeed, the whole issue of the crisis of IDPs revolves around the land problem in Kenya, and I will come back to that later. Now, one of the reasons why I'm sneezing is because Joel Bakan and his lovely family gave us dinner up to midnight last night, and the red one that he gave me was, I think was blessed by the Pope. Now, what we have done in responding to these four agenda items Kofi Annan's intervention, that immediately a commission has been set up to look at the electoral debacle, the issue why the electoral commission mismanaged the electoral process so badly. and what needs to be done to put in place an electoral commission that will stand the test of time and that will manage democratic elections in Kenya. The second thing that has been done is to put a committee to investigate into electoral violence. You can halt the violence, you can restore peace and so on, but unless you look at the fundamental causes of that electoral violence and put in place certain institutional mechanisms for avoiding electoral violence in the future, as you can see, it can happen again. The Grand Coalition government, on the other hand, is meant to be a holding operation to husband these reforms in a period of 1 to 2 years, after which it is hoped that Kenya can have an election where Kenyans will have the opportunity to put in place a government elected by the people and not leaders choosing their electors. You must understand there's a very interesting phenomenon in Africa now, maybe it is elsewhere too, where leaders choose electors rather than electors electing leaders. How does this happen? If you write the rules of the game in such a way that you predetermine who will be elected in the end, you actually chosen yourself. Or if you let people vote and in the end you close the votes in a cupboard and say they will not be counted because I am assumed to be elected, you actually elect yourself. You choose the voters and you say those ones who voted, those ones voted wrongly. The others who didn't vote approve of my being here anyway, so I'm now your leader following a democratic election. It's very reminiscent of Banda's statement. Banda was once asked by Philip Schott that, Mr. President, people accuse you of being a dictator. Do you agree or not? And Banda said, yes, I agree. But I am a dictator that the people choose to put up with. So, and this is where you have African presidents. They are presidents which people choose to put up with, notwithstanding the fact that they are the ones who determine who to vote for them, and the people don't determine who they vote for. So we hope that within these 1 or 2 years, we'll put in place an electoral process which will rise up to the true democratic dictum, government by the people, for the people, and of the people. Now, what are the possibilities that this is likely to happen? That it's likely to happen that, according to a non-agenda, a grand coalition made up of the ODM and PNU will actually put in place a constitutional dispensation that will do away with the presidential authoritarian system and put in place a parliamentary democracy. Big question. But I don't want to answer it now. Let me answer it a little bit later. But at the moment, let me look into why is it that it was not possible for the PNU to impose itself on the people of Kenya through a robbed or stolen election. There are several issues we must look into. One, there are multiple interests in the Kenyan political scene. I will begin with an interest closer home, the American interest. One must understand that the U.S. has the largest embassy in Kenya, in Africa, today. It used to be in Liberia many years ago, the years of the Two Whig Party. But then the Two Whigs were sent packing. I think Kenya now is one of the largest embassies in Africa. Is that right? I think so.
It is.
So that's a major investment, and you're not going to play around with it, because it doesn't just serve Kenya, it serves the whole region. And if you look into the future, and you want to deal with the command, African command thing in Stuttgart and bring it to Africa, you're likely to bring it somewhere within the vicinity of that embassy, logistically speaking. I think it's fair to assume so, although in these days of good communication it could be anywhere. But that investment is very important. Secondly, there is the issue of counter-terrorism, countering terrorism. Given the instability in the Great Lakes region, and given the economic importance of Great Lakes region, you must understand the Great Lakes region is where the Democratic Republic of the Congo is, with all its contested wealth since the 1960s. And the Great Lakes region is where Sudan is. And these are two of Africa's largest countries and largest economies potentially. So the kind of political system that exists in Kenya and, as it were, guarantees American interest is very important to the U.S., I think. The third issue why Kenya is so important is because the role it has played in providing humanitarian access to the region, a region that's politically unstable, where terrorism can occur anytime. You need to send food. I understand the Americans are feeding the Zimbabweans the rate of how many million dollars a month, and that can be done through South Africa, but maybe even food aid to Sudan, to Somalia, and all these humanitarian things must have an entree point, and Kenya provides it. Not to forget that not just for the Americans, but the region as a whole, it is also a hub for communication, air communication and so on. And fourthly, there's the issue of being a diplomatic partner in the politics of the Great Lakes. Whether you're talking about Somalia, we're talking about Ethiopia, the proximity to Addis Ababa, an issue that the Americans share with other people. And finally, I think, which is very important, is the role of UN headquarters in Kenya and the what are called a spillover effect in the region to what happens in Kenya. These, I think, are some of the strategic reasons, I think, where not just the U.S. government but other governments would be concerned about what happens in Kenya more than what happens in Somalia, Djibouti, and some of these states around. I mean, nobody comes from this. But Ned, I mean, we consider.
Our former ambassador to Djibouti is here.
Okay. But secondly, and not just the U.S., you go back to Africa. African countries take Kenya very seriously. First, the fight against Afro-pessimism is not something small. I remember going around during this crisis to Tanzania, to Uganda, to Ethiopia, and even talking to Somali. And all they were saying, if Kenya fails, what next? Or as the Somalis were saying, Kenya is like an uncle. If he dies, whom do we turn to? So this fight against Afro-pessimism, which people want some successful stories in Africa, and this is why Zimbabwe annoys very many people. And Zimbabwe has no reason to be what it is today, except for Mugabe. But also the role of Kenya in terms of regional integration. COMESA, IGAD, East African communities, regional investments, the Rwandans, the Ugandans, the Tanzanians, the Somalis, the Sudanese, especially Southern Sudanese, invest heavily in Kenya, not just in real estate, but other things. They invest in the stock market, as you saw with the IPO on Safaricom, which has problems, but nonetheless, they do invest there. And of course, the provision of services in the region. Secondary schools, primary schools, a lot of people within the region actually make use of services from Kenya, not to mention hospitals and financial and insurance services. When, therefore, the crisis occurred, there were all these interests that were concerned about its solution. Now, even China sees Kenya as a gateway for her commercial interests in Africa, so does Japan. Great Britain, of course, there are these ties that bind us with Great Britain, which are many. Great Britain's investments in Kenya are substantial. The East African Society really operates between London and Nairobi. John Small and the other gentleman, the shuttle between Nairobi and London as heads of the East African Society. But why did Kenya break down? If all this, I'm not talking about the Kenyans themselves not wanting the break. What? Why did it break down? I think it broke down because of the following. First, the immediate cause, the stolen elections. It annoyed Kenyans. Kenyans were poised for change after the referendum. The ODM had done what I consider quite a substantial work in mobilizing Kenyans to expect this change. The stakes were very high. The stakes between the PNU and ODM, and both sides of the divide expected a free democratic election to settle the contest. And people voted in their big numbers And I remember even a friend calling me from Kiambu and said, well, now that the ODM is leading by 1 million votes, we can accept to live with an ODM government. But when all of a sudden things were done at night, at the Electoral Commission, in KICC, in broad view of television lights and so on, and you could hear comments from Radio Tanzania, Tanzania Television, and all the others about what was happening, it caused tremendous crisis of identity with the people, with the electoral process. And the reaction was spontaneous against what happened. And you must remember that in the final analysis, all struggles for democracy are first and foremost struggles about the rules of the game. How do the rules put down in such a way that they lead to a contest that is free and fair? When people saw that the rules of the game were themselves being violated by the very institution that was expected to protect them, the Electoral Commission, it was really upsetting. And don't think that is something just only intellectuals understand. Even the man on the street could speak about it. He said, but we voted yesterday. We think the Electoral Commission is the last body that should do this. So if they can't look after our votes, let me take a panga and chop the next fellow, because I think he is responsible. And thirdly, one of the major causes of why Kenya collapsed was because of what I called the failed or the frustrated process of reform that started in 1991 and came up to the year 2007 without being fulfilled. The reform of the Constitution. You remember in 1991 when Section 2A, just one section of the Constitution, was removed, that removed the possibility of continuing a one-party system and introduced the possibility of a two-party system. It was seen by the people of Kenya as a major breakthrough, because for the first time, another party other than KANU could hold a rally in Nairobi. And the first rally in Kamukunji was attended by about 500,000 people. So that was seen as a major breakthrough. After that, people expected more to come. But then they have been very slow to come. In 97, where there was the reform of the Electoral Commission, where Moi agreed that other parties could nominate people to the Electoral Commission with regard to their proportionality or membership in Parliament, it was agreed, but it was not written into law. But Moi observed it all the time he was president. Kibaki was a beneficiary of this dispensation, and on that dispensation he was elected in 2002, but decided that since the thing was not written into law, he was not going to observe it. So he staffed the Electoral Commission with his men and women. Out of 22 commissioners, 19 were Kibaki appointees. Contrary to the agreement in 1997, Kenyans saw the clock being turned backwards at a time when it should be going forward. Again, in 2002, in order to deal with the authoritarian constitution, the opposition came together in a broad coalition called the National Rainbow Coalition, in an agreement written in a memorandum of understanding, which was not written into law. As soon as Kibaki was a beneficiary of that understanding, he decided to go against it. So the process of reform was always being frustrated, A, by the authoritarian presidency, and two, by not changing the authoritarian constitution at all. So when in 2007, another broad coalition was formed by the Orange Democratic Movement, which was able to win the majority in parliament and the majority of the vote for the presidency, but that then defeated to the manipulation of the Electoral Commission, this caused a major crisis in society. So we ask ourselves, under what circumstances can this authoritarian regime be transformed through the popular vote? One, there are possibility if the authoritarian regime itself becomes too weak to continue in office. If it becomes too weak to continue and so forth, purely internal reasons, it can be defeated in an election, notwithstanding the constitution. By being too weak, I mean, if it cannot control the Electoral Commission, it cannot manipulate the army to support it, the police and the administration police, the National Security Intelligence Agency, and so on. If all these institutions are too divided or too weak to support the authoritarian regime, you can actually defeat it in an election. And this is what happened in Zimbabwe. In Zimbabwe, one of the reasons why the MDC was defeating Mugabe is because there's tremendous division in the armed apparatuses of the state. The Central Intelligence Organization was on one side, the army was on the other side. So Mugabe could not actually easily manipulate the electoral process. All he could do is make sure, wait until it voted, and then begin locking the votes in the cupboard and refusing that even if they're unaccounted, it doesn't matter. But in Kenya, on the other hand, Kibaki was still very strong. Controlled the National Security Intelligence Services, the army command is on his side, administration police had just been given support by the U.S. and they were recruited more people, he had recruited more policemen, so the armed apparatus of the state were on his side. So I think it was comfortable to say, well, you can vote, but I will call my boys to deal with you characters, which he did. And I tell you, the kind of beating we got during demonstrations were not small. Secondly, if there is, in the event that it is not terribly strong, but it has access to militia, like Mugiki and so on, it can resort to the use of militia to maintain itself in power. This is not just with reference to Kenya, and other African countries too, where militias have been used to protect an unpopular regime, even when it messes up with elections. But thirdly, if there is such a strong hegemony of reform politics that in spite of the strength of the authoritarian regime, the hegemony of reform movement itself can force it out of power. And this, by the way, was a crisis in Kenya after the vote was stolen. The reform agenda, the reform forces were so strong in the media, you know, the FM stations, the television, there were so many, they were bombarding the government with all kinds of critics. Civil society is strong with a reform agenda, and the reform agenda had also now been supported by development partners. You remember, in 1992, 1997, development partners were there, but they never really came out very strongly to support the reform process. They did it in a lukewarm manner. But this time, because they also knew there was a very strong civil society, a very strong press, development partners could actually march to Kenyatta International Conference and take a stand. I think they took a stand because they knew that we have real partners who can power with us in this process. But the other thing is that this authoritarian regime can also be defeated in an election in spite of the authoritarian constitution, if it cannot easily resort to mobilize purely ethnic support for itself. Now, the PNU was trying to mobilize purely ethnic support, and to some extent that was the rhetoric on which it was trying to survive. But even within that ethnic bloc, there were still voices of dissent which were pretty strong. People like Maina Kiai and so on, very, very strong. And they had a constituency which was supporting what we were saying, and which also came up in the private sector alliance and so on. And finally, if it can use fear-mongering politics effectively, and this is what did not succeed in Kenya, fear-mongering politics was there, but it could not be that effective given the hegemony of reform politics in society. What, therefore, does the Kenyan experience show? The Kenyan's experience, I think, show the following things. That if the constitution remains authoritarian and the incumbent regime defy the outcome of an electoral process and can resort to the use of armed might, it can actually stay in power. But the other thing that the Kenyan experience shows, that attempts to do that with faced with a very strong reform constituency in the country is not very easy to get away with. And I think this is why the Annan initiative succeeded, because at the discussions, you could see the PNU is ticking, or the ODM must go to court, we are not going to move. But out there, the papers, editorials were telling them, this is unviable. The church was telling them, this cannot be tenable. The development partners say, this cannot be tenable. Trade unions were saying, this cannot be tenable. So although on the one hand, it tried to keep itself in power by using fear-mongering and whatnot, but the reform constituency could not let it go. And therefore, it was possible for the Annan process to succeed. Don't think that the Annan process succeeded because Annan is a genius, of course, but I think without that kind of atmosphere, I don't think it would have succeeded. Now, but finally, I think it is important to say that structural and constitutional reforms are necessary conditions for frameworking elections as processes for democratic change in Africa, particularly in Kenya. Structural and institutional constitutional reforms are necessary conditions for frameworking elections as processes for democratic change in Africa. That's very important. You can have elections like you have in Ethiopia, but without reforms, they cannot lead to any kind of democratic change. I mean, so African countries can comfortably organize elections every 5 years, religiously. But if there are no fundamental constitution and structural reforms, they lead to no democratic change. But in Kenya, we have reached a stage where the accord itself has embedded in that agreement an agenda for reform, particularly constitutional reform. And the best thing that CSIS can do for us is to monitor that process and keep a bird's eye and say, you people signed this. Annan, you signed. Kikwete, you signed. Mkapa, you signed. Kibaki, you signed. Raila, you signed. You said you are going to do it for 2 years. Have you done so? Item 1, 2, 3, 4. Because you are justified to make that demand. After all, as I showed you, your own society has a vested interest in Kenya. Although I would ask you to reduce your visa fees. So finally, what therefore must now happen in Kenya at this point in time? One, priority must be given to the reform agenda, agenda item number 4 on the Annan process. Two, I think preparations for giving the people an opportunity for electing their leaders must be put in place right now, because that is an outstanding grudge of the people of Kenya against their leaders. Three, there must be an intense conversation on a democratic political culture in Kenya. When people talk about tribalism, ethnic biases, and so on, we think that the thing that should happen is not to blame Kenyans all the time for being tribally divided, but to provide the opportunity for a discourse on a democratic political culture. And we in the ODM have proposed that the first conference we want to be held in Nairobi is a conference on the ethnic question. Let people come and talk about ethnicity openly without pretending that it doesn't exist. There must be a national conference on the ethnic question. What do Kikuyus hold against the Luos against Kikuyus, the Baluyas against the Majikandas, and they took our land, Kenyatta brought them here, Kenyatta should take them back. I mean, those issues must be put on the table, and the ethnic question must be discussed. Is it a question because of inequitable access to resources or not? Is that why it arises? So those are some of the issues that I think must be put on the table if indeed the Kenyan crisis is going to be addressed in a long-term fashion. Joel, I've talked too much. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a very comprehensive, erudite, and at times, obviously, provocative presentation. I want to take the prerogative of the chair and ask two quick questions following on just your conclusion. The first with respect to reform in the electoral system and what happened there. In retrospect, with the classic 2020 hindsight, it would appear that both Kenyans and the international community placed far too much emphasis on the reappointment of Samuel Kivito as the chair and lost sight of what was going on institutionally. But the same could be said for the opposition and the domestic monitors. And so one question is, why was not much said at the time by ODM or the Domestic Observer Group about the packing of the commission, and also loopholes such as the reporting of the vote and all these things that we now see very clearly after the vote is over. The second is to come back to the Constitution. You've addressed the problem, but you haven't really gone to grapple with some of the key issues, such as presidential powers, such as devolution, the balance between the legislature and the executive. And I wonder whether you could go into that a bit, particularly in terms of the contesting interests, and just what the likelihood is for a suitable draft, as you say, a new rules of the game by which everybody can play, because that, of course, as you rightly said, is key to it. But what are the actual prospects of getting from here to there, given the competing interests at stake?
Yeah. Very good. Do you want me to respond to that before we open? Well, let me respond to that so that you can. First, we made a mistake by putting too much faith in the reappointment equivalent. I think in some ways we were in a zone of self-denial. One, we tried to get through Parliament a minimum reform package, which was agreed to by all parties, by the way. And a bill was actually drafted and given to Martha Karua, the Minister for Justice and Constitutional Affairs, to introduce the Cabinet and take it to the Business Committee of Parliament so that it be debated. Martha Karua sat on the bill, and I think by the advice of the President, because the President did not want to lose his powers. That minimum reform agenda, if you looked at it, addressed the issue of the Electoral Commission, autonomy of Parliament, reduction of certain presidential powers, the hearing of election petitions that were to be heard within the first 6 months after the election. It had a very good package, which was a short-term agenda to open up the political process and to reduce the executive control of the process of the Parliament. And it was frustrated. So then we kind of, rather than do what we did in 97, go to the streets and begin demonstrating no reform, no election, we said, well, look, if only we organize ourselves and make sure that the vote is counted at the polling station, we shall defeat these people. So we went and had a 2.5 meeting with Kivuitu and his commissioners, and they put up a very good show. They told us, well, you know, we have been accused of being appointed by Kibaki, but gentlemen, you might understand we are Kenyans. We would not like this country to go up in smoke. These are the electoral laws. We have agreed there will be observers. There can be as many observers you people like. I mean, it was a very good public relations exercise. And Kivuitu, we then met him as chairman, and he told us over his dead body, the body is still alive to this very day. He wouldn't have, so we were duped. We shouldn't have. Secondly, I think one of the things that in hindsight I look back, we kept on getting reports that, look, you people, this election is going to be stolen. There are votes being cast already, which will be counted. I discussed this with Raila. Raila said, no, that's rather romantic. I mean, how can that happen? But it was happening. And those are the votes that were then stuffed in ballot box or whatever between the collating of the votes at constituency level in certain areas and KICC. And then we were told, no, you people must be very careful. In KICC, there are people, they have met with the Ugandans, electoral commissioners, and the Ugandans have taught them how to rig this thing. I said, no, that doesn't sound right. But these things happened. So I think that we were too optimistic, let me say. And we had too much faith that we had mobilized people. We thought the future was orange, so there was no problem. And so we didn't just take care of it. And I think the development partners were equally duped because Kivuitu assured them that he would put a leash on his commissioners. The thing, what is the moral of the story? The moral of the story is the following. Don't rely on subjective dispensations, i.e., individual will of people. Subject individual will to rules and regulations and institutions. If the rules, the regulations, institutions are there, then good people will behave good and bad people will be restrained. But if the rules and institutions are weak and aren't there, good people are likely to be bad when they are tempted with money. In fact, Samuel Arap Ngeny, one of the commissioners, which perhaps is the only clean commissioner, as well, he pulled me aside and told me at KICC, we were together in high school, when we were having that problem with the all kinds of votes being counted which were not there, pulled me aside and told me, you know, you see all these commissioners, money can do great things. That's what he told me. They were passing around it. These ones, money can do great things. So they were all taken. So the point is, there should have been the implementation of that minimum reform package if the Electoral Commission was going to perform well. But the reform package was never implemented. And so we are taken to the cleaners. Now, next time we shall not rely on a Kivuitu. I think we rely on a commission that is properly institutionalized. The Constitution. Yes, sorry, Joel, I didn't say too much. But remember what I said. The problem with our Constitution is that it has been amended, Ndegwa, how many times? 37 times. 37 times since independence. Every time it has been amended, it has been to concentrate power in the presidency. Even the formation of ministries, every time you add ministries in the past, the new ministries created were ministries in the office of the president. Look at them. At independence, defense was independent, a separate ministry altogether, in a different building. It became Minister for Defense in the president's office. Home Affairs used to be part and parcel. Internal Security used to be part and parcel of Home Affairs. They created Internal Security and Provincial Administration, Minister of State, in the office of the President. Special programs, where a lot of money go, and it's highly accounted for, by the way. Minister of State in the office of the President. So the President's office became a ginormous thing. And if you look at the amendments to the Constitution, first, declaring Kenya a unitary state instead of a federal state, centralizing things rather than devolution. A one-party state, centralized things in the office of the president. Detention without trial, giving the president a pen to deprive you of liberty at will. Okay? Formation of the ECK, by the way, there was never an ECK, there was a supervisor of elections, which, by the way, at independence was the attorney general's office. All these people were now appointed by the president. If you look at the rise of an authoritarian presidential regime, which I've written about extensively, has a problem. The whole debate in Bomas was to say, look, let us decongest the presidency by dispersing executive power, by introducing devolution and so on. And so the crisis we have really is that the suitable draft, as far as I'm concerned, is an improved Bomas draft, like the kind of draft that Yash Gai has produced now, which is a hybrid between Bomas, the Khalifi, and so on. I'm saying I'm an improved Bomas draft, because Bomas draft should have been discussed extensively in Parliament before it was taken to a referendum, but it was never, because the government hijacked it and made it Khalifi, which was a mule, really, rather than a horse. It was a mixture of all kinds of things. So I think between now and when we have a new constitution, we should get those drafts, put them together before an expert group to advise and look at the concerns of Kenyans. And we have to make a decision. Are we going to have a presidential system of government or a parliamentary system? Not this thing that was hatched up in England between Thurgood Marshall and the others, which had a nostalgia for Britain and the US, and they produced a president and a prime minister, and then it has not worked. The president took everything in the end.
Okay, many hands. Dave Peterson to start.
Morning, Peter. Raila was sworn in yesterday as Prime Minister, and part of the compromise agreement included, I think, if I remember the number correctly, was 90 cabinet ministers. That's something like half of the entire parliament, which itself is one of the highest paid parliaments in the world. How do you respond to the charge that Kenya's political elites have not served well the Kenyan people from either party?
Samuel Adeni Jones from the Office of the Secretary, Department of Health and Human Services. Two very quick questions. The first one, for this interim period to work, apart from the sort of structural balance of power that you've created, operationally, how is it going to work? How is the balance going to operationally work between the president, the prime minister, and the parliament? And a more self-serving question. I was asked to come here and ask you how the balance of power within the Ministry of Health is going to work. The ministry has been divided into two. Is this part of the power sharing process?
Good morning, Professor Jan van Leeuwen. I'm a private citizen who is a proud owner of a home in Kenya. I have two quick questions, actually, following up very specifically on my neighbor. Do, as the Prime Minister normally would be the one in charge of his cabinet, you mentioned already the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Affairs, the famous Martha. Is she going to report to Raila Odinga? And the second question is... I understand that there are no conflict of interest laws in Kenya that would prevent politicians to have substantial business interests, which I personally believe is one of the root causes for some of the endemic corruption in the country. Is this a subject of discussion and that might be addressed in the upcoming constitution?
Size of the cabinet. Let me correct it. There are 40-something cabinet ministers. I can't quite remember. 41 or 42?
42.
Those are cabinet ministers. Those are the only ones who attend cabinet meetings. Then we have 50 assistant ministers who are people who answer questions in parliament. I mean, the idea of assistant ministers is really controversial in Kenya because really what we should have are deputy ministers, people who can deputize for ministers effectively. Assistant ministers are really sinecure jobs where you find that you have appointed one minister from Kisii, but you say, well, there are about 10 members of parliament from Kisii. This one is from Nyamira. We need somebody from Gucha, but we can't have two of them. So you give one minister from Nyamira, and then you get assistant from Gucha and put him there. That's how it works. Basically, there are a few occasions when assistant ministers actually are appointed and they have substantial responsibilities. Usually, for example, in finance, you appoint an assistant minister because the responsibility is too much. So the assistant minister can take care of a lot of day-to-day things in finance when the minister concentrates on the World Bank, IMF, all these things. Foreign affairs, too, because the Minister of Foreign Affairs travels too much. So somebody must be around who really manages. There are certain ministries where having a deputy minister makes a lot of sense, okay, or assistant minister. But when you have like two assistant ministers to one minister. But having said that, you know, you have to make a choice in a grand coalition like this. Do you want it to exist for a short time and accomplish the work it's supposed to do as efficiently as possible with less fights and kind of grudges and whatnot? Or do you want to make sure that it's inclusive, it does what it does, comes with a new constitution which will limit the cabinet to 25 ministers? That's what the Bomas draft did, so that it becomes a necessity. Necessity is the mother of invention. I mean, it is necessary to have it at that point in time. This is the argument that has been used. I'm not quite sure I'm convinced, but it's a plausible argument. I say, look, we, and this is what Kibaki said, because when we went, when our position as ODM was, we want 25 ministers. That is what we put in our manifesto. And indeed, the day that we were interrupted, we were meeting at the Pentagon and discussing the cabinet. When somebody came and said, "You people are discussing the cabinet, the votes are not there." So stand up and go to Kenyatta and the conference and find out what we are waiting on. So we left that meeting. We have never resumed it. But then when we started this discussion, Kibaki had appointed 17 ministers. So we said, okay, fine, it's going to be very difficult for him to dismiss 17, so let's agree to 34. So we said 34 is the number. But Kibaki's argument, well, look, I have too many constituencies to please. When I was appointing the 17, I forgot Kiambu. Kiambu is too big to have only one minister. I forgot Nairobi. You know, so you people sympathize with me. So Raila came and reported to us. We said, no. That was his problem. Who told him to appoint anyway? But then in the end, they went in there and they came with 40, and I'm a beneficiary, so I don't know. But I think we are going to live with it. It is not good for the Kenyan people. I mean, it raised a tremendous crisis of legitimacy. My wife called me. I was here when she said, I'm not going to the swearing in. You people are too many. We are taxpayers. She harangued me. I said, I'm still coming back anyway. So I know it is a terrible crisis. For a year, if it can deliver a constitution and stop all this violence and make sure that we have a new political system, maybe in retrospect, we will be happy about it. Opportunity, how is the Grand Coalition going to work in reality? The Grand Coalition is going to be a very difficult marriage, or two partners who just put up with each other because they have to have children. And once they have two children, they may divorce. We have come together because Kenya must be governed. There must be a new constitution. Once we have a new constitution, we may divorce. And I think we shall. That is the reality. If the Grand Coalition can fulfill the Annan agenda, good enough. People go to election and a new constitution. Let us have a proper government with a cabinet that can perform. That is the position that I take. But it's not going to be easy. Let's not kid ourselves. It's not going to be easy because a coalition by its very nature brings people with all kinds of tendencies and persuasions. They are not ideologically harmonious, but precisely because they come together because none of them can do it by themselves. So necessity is the mother of invention. They are invented to do a certain job. Health, I don't know, because I was told I was minister of medical services when I was in New York. I don't know what medical services really mean. I've been asking people, what's the difference between medical services and public health? Some people tell me, oh, public health is due to making sure that people are vaccinated and latrines are there and restaurants are clean and that there is medicine in hospitals. Medical services means hospitals must be there, doctors must be there, nurses must be there, research stations must be there and so on. So when I go back, I'll see my Tamosa. I don't know. But I think yes, it is part and parcel of sharing power, because if you are going to have 40 ministers, somehow you have to create them. So, for example, they divided roads and public works. Roads are ministry, public works are not ministry. It doesn't make sense to me. They went to tourism and wildlife. They created tourism and took wildlife to forests. I don't know. So where the tourists, what are they going to see? They have to go and see wildlife. So it doesn't really make sense if you are serious and try to analyze how these ministries were created. That's why I'm saying, I mean, this Grand Coalition is not going to be easy, because people are going to step on each other's toes. Beth Bugo, who is the other Minister of Public Health, has big toes. That's all fine. So.
Could you address the question that was asked, though, about the reporting?
To the Prime Minister.
That's a bit puzzling.
Yeah, that's a very important question. The Prime Minister's job, which is in the Constitution, it's only the Prime Minister and the President who have the job specific in the Constitution. I mean, in the Cabinet, that's it. The Prime Minister's job is to coordinate and supervise government actions and operations. All ministers report to the Prime Minister. I understand, the way I understand it, that once the Prime Minister, since he was sworn in yesterday, takes office, the office of the head of public service will become redundant. Because the Prime Minister will, in actual fact, doing the job of the head of public service. The head of public service now is three in one. It's like the Godhead. He's head of public service, secretary of the cabinet, and PS in the president's office. The PS in the president's office will be a PS. Secretary of the cabinet will resort to the secretary of the cabinet as we knew it and independence, Wamalwa. He was a secretary of the cabinet and nothing else a civil servant who keeps cabinet records and therefore reports to both the president and the prime minister. Head of public service is, for all intents and purposes, now the prime minister. And in the prime minister's office, there is a minister of state in charge of public service, Dalmas Otieno. So the PS of state in charge of public service will, for all intents and purposes, be the person playing Mudaura. Well, Mudaura, for all intents and purposes, as I know, is out of job. In any case, he's 66, so he can. So I think there will be a reporting system to the prime minister as the man who coordinates government work. So all ministers will, including Martha Karua and myself, we are in the same boat. Yeah.
Steve, you had your hand up. Hi, Steve Webb from the World Bank. It seemed like one of the surprising things in Kenya was the extent to which different political leaders were able to mobilize violence, mobilize groups to act violently against the supporters of the others. And so my question is, going forward and getting a longer-term solution, how can it really seems like there's two questions. One, how can the leaders credibly commit not to mobilize violence in the future? And how can the state credibly commit to protect those who don't mobilize violence against someone else who might?
The gentleman before I asked a question about, my name is John Mlai, I write for the East African Standard. I'm based here. The question is, you've talked a lot about the reform agenda, its strength and momentum. And you also talked to somebody, raised the question of the political elite and whether it's in touch, it's in tandem with the speed of change that is being forced onto society. Is there a risk in Kenya at the moment that actually the reform agenda mobilized by the people will overtake the elite and actually push them out of the way? Because some of the actions the elite have taken lately have really caused a lot of dissatisfaction among the ordinary people, and they may be looking for alternative solutions and actually just dispense with you altogether.
Thank you. Guy Nzaribe, I'm in private consulting here. I have a question, and it's got to do with the Constitution. You seem to lay a lot of emphasis, a lot of store on the production of a Constitution. Until now, the way has been characterized by the ODM being outmaneuvered by Kibaki. How are we sure we get to that point in 2 years? I mean, how do you give people confidence that you'll get to that point? Your story about the creation of this ministerial post, which is really an outrage in Kenya at the moment, leads to the suspicion that you're again going to yield one way or the other to Kibaki. Thank you.
From the bottom up. You know, if the stealing of the election has succeeded, the assumption was that, well, election with robbed or stolen, people will riot for 2 days and that will be the end of it. But it didn't happen like that. So you can say that Kibaki didn't outmaneuver ODM as was planned. Why didn't he outmaneuver ODM as was planned? Because, as I said, the hegemony of the reform agenda is very strong, not just in the ODM, but elsewhere. Secondly, is Kibaki going to be able to outmaneuver the ODM in the reform agenda now? Very unlikely, because, unlike before, the reform agenda is now in an act of parliament with many more players having a stake in it than before. And if you read that accord and the act of parliament, and by the way, both the accord and the act are embedded in the constitution, if you read it very well, so it ties down the coalition, the grand coalition, to a time action plan, which since we are in government, is going to be very difficult to they will try, but I think it's much more difficult than before. All these are struggles, really. And if I was Kibaki, I would not give in easily. I would also struggle to maintain my turf. I would struggle to stop the reform agenda from succeeding. But what I'm saying is that, unlike before, I think it's going to be rather more difficult now. Secondly, it is also tied to the nature of the way the Grand Coalition has been formed. By appointing a cabinet of 40, assistant ministers of 50, it makes the Grand Coalition rather weak in the face of the people. The people are gaining a lot of power against government. And John Mulai is right. If unless we don't move very quickly to respond to the reform agenda, you can't see a popular uprising of the Kenyan people against the government easily. Because if my own wife can call and harass me, where is the constituency? So I think don't underestimate the power of Kenyans. I think the era will change here. I think the days of the authoritarian presidents in Africa are actually numbered. I may be too romantic, but I think they are. I think the power of the reform is on the agenda. Even in Zimbabwe, I don't want to predict, but it's going to be very difficult for Mugabe to get away with it. Why do you think, for example, that Zuma beat Mbeki in the ANC elections? Okay, Mbeki was doing very well in terms of economic reform, but it was to the benefit of the elite. They did very well in housing and water provision. I was in South Africa during the APRM. But there was something which was not answered, the politics of inclusion and the economics of equity. Those two issues, the politics of inclusion, the economics of equity, is something that people are very conscious of. It's not just a theory. It is something that people are demanding. And unless, in spite of the big cabinet, we respond to the politics of inclusion and economics of equity, Mulai is right. I mean, we'll find a force. I wouldn't be surprised if in the next election the number of people defeated in parliament is even higher than what we saw this time, if we don't respond to the reform agenda. That's what I think. The leaders mobilizing violence, it was terrible. If I had time, I would tell you some of the personal stories I had with some of these leaders who confessed openly that they did finance militias. Because we were going through a moment of madness, really, where the stakes were so high and people thought that by arming militias, they would actually defeat the other side, but they were just making the situation worse. Those militias are now back on the street, causing havoc to everybody. Now, the solution to this, I think, is to professionalize the security apparatus of the state, not to ethnicize it. Once you ethnicize the administration police, the GSU, it's very dangerous. Then somebody can also ethnicize a militia and challenge that ethnicized apparatus of the state. The trouble we have in Kenya is that we must address the issue of professionalizing the armed apparatus of the state. For example, I could see it in the army during this crisis. There was a clear division between PNU supporters and ODM supporters. Clear division. And I'm telling you, if that accord had not been signed on that Thursday, by Saturday, Kenya would have been a different story. It would have been a different story. Because I was right there in Senate, I knew it. So I think one of the things we need to do is, in this process of reform, we must professionalize the security forces, have examinations that people really sit, or promotion systems that are professional, so that security forces can deal with the militia. At the moment, the police cannot deal with the militia because the police is ethnicized. The militia can collude with the police to come to the streets and surprise everybody, and then a whole police commissioner tells us that we were taken by surprise. I mean, it's not possible where you have the National Security Intelligence Services and so on. So the ethnicization of the armed apparatus of the state is a very dangerous thing. It makes it possible for the militia to operate.
John Elliott from Human Rights Watch. Just picking up on your theme about violence, I hear what you say about reform and de-ethnicizing the security forces, but isn't accountability and impunity a key part of this problem? For too many years, militias, politicians have been organizing groups against their neighbors. Don't we need to see some accountability for those responsible for the violence in January? And what specific proposals are you discussing within the Grand Coalition to deal with this issue?
My name is Peter Gakunu. I'm from the IMF. I just really want to make some kind of a comment in addition to asking a question. Yes. I feel like my colleague from the Standard that the violence we saw in Kenya just found an excuse to come up, because maybe the problem of social injustice between the rich and the poor, maybe the issue of the land issues, the issue of unemployment, maybe these underlying causes were actually waiting for an opportunity to arise. And maybe the elections gave that opportunity. What's your comment?
Yeah, thank you. Philippe DuPonte from Eurasia Group. Now that the ODM is a partner, in fact, in this coalition government, and I'm struck, it still sounds like full opposition. But in any case, now that you're a partner of this government, I'm interested in hearing a little bit about priorities when it comes to the economic management of the country. Kenya, like so many countries, is facing a crisis of inflation in general, agflation in particular. And I'm wondering how you view that. And in general, sort of how would you differentiate the ODM philosophy on economic policymaking versus the PNU philosophy? Thanks.
I'll start with the ODM philosophy in economic management. You remember I talked about the economics of equity. And it ties down with my friend Peter Gakunu's point. If you have an economy, a market economy in a developing society, which has ambitions of being an emerging market, and you let the state tolerate and in actual fact encourage rent-seeking opportunities and hiving off monopoly tendencies in that economy to certain elites, you do two things. You frustrate the possibilities of becoming an emerging market. And two, you create a non-expansive economy in which a whole lot of people are subjected to poverty, not because they cannot advance themselves, but because they are denied opportunity. I'll give you an example in agriculture. I come from a sugar area, sugar growing. We've been growing sugar ever since I can remember. But there is a vested interest within the elite that Kenya must only produce 400,000 tons of metric tons of sugar and import 200,000 metric tons. That has been there as a standard philosophy. You are not allowed to produce more than 400,000 tons, never, even if you have the potential. Why do they do so? Because importing sugar gives windfall earnings to this monopolistic elite in the state at the expense of the farmer, so that there's poverty in the sugar belt, not because people can't work and do better and even add value to the economy, but because of these rent-seeking tendencies and comprador bourgeois in the state that must keep on adding to their laurels money from sugar. That's just one example. But you can We did away with trade licensing, all those great things that the World Bank was fighting against, and the IMF, and they did succeed. And so Kenya emerged. Even we were giving a medal the other day for bureaucratic reform and so on. But that is window dressing, really, in reality. So our philosophy was the following as a party. One, let us do away with this kind of thing. Let us have less bureaucratic intervention. Let us have a professional civil service. Let's give people opportunities. Let the state invest in agriculture by investing in infrastructure, by trying to see whether agricultural inputs can be cheaper and so on. Let's give these people opportunity to create wealth. Our ERS, Economic Recovery Fund, which I did when I was in planning, was predicated on two things: employment creation and wealth creation. Because my idea was, I was told by these development partners, I think, I don't know what Jeremy was there, but I was told that, no, you must talk about poverty reduction. This wealth creation is elitist. So it's not elitist. You cannot create jobs if you don't create wealth. So wealth creation must be the ambition of every peasant, as well as every captain of industry. And it worked, by the way. That's why we were gaining 5% rate of growth and so on. So I think that is development economics 101 for Kenyans, I think. And I think it works. And if we do that, we will get the other priorities correct. And if we fight corruption, which is at the base of that sugar thing, for example, it can replicate itself in other sectors. We'll get a lot of things correct. But then, even if you have all the laws like Economic Crimes Act that we have, Kenya Anti-Corruption Commission, unless you deal with his point, accountability and punity. And then you must have leaders which are elected by the people who could take this issue seriously and whom can be recalled by the people if they don't take those things seriously. And that's why I was, in the final analysis, coming down to the Constitution and rules of the game that make it possible for people who transgress to be punished by the people and by the institutions that should punish them. So these things must be taken together. My specific proposals regarding impunity and accountability. One is we have put in place a committee to look at electoral violence and recommend ways of doing things. But the right thing to do is to dismantle these ethnic militias. You cannot dismantle them if the armed apparatuses of the state are not professional, because it is armed apparatuses of the state which are going to dismantle them. The army can dismantle the Mugikis and so on if there was a political will to do so. Because to tell you the truth, these Mugikis are not that many anyway, and they cannot stand against a combined force of the army, the NSIS, and the police. But now they do, because there's collaboration across the forces. Peter and Joel, the land issue is a big topic, but you know, I told you that in the Bomas of Kenya, there's one of the best expressions how to deal with the land issue in Kenya. Because the land issue is not a historical thing. It's at the bottom of it is unequal access to land that was organized by the state. For example, at independence, when after the emergency, when the Kikuyu peasants were taken to hamlets and concentration camps, and they came out and they found their land had already been enclosed by the Home Guards. Rather than Kenyatta facing that issue of inequality in central Kenya created by that emergency politics, he exported class contradictions from central province to the Rift Valley. And what happened, this is the guy who studied these things, what happened during colonial times, he knows, is that these Rift Valley farms, which were mixed farms, inefficient and so on, at independence we were given money to buy them and settle people. Who were the people who were settled in difference? Korasoi and all these places. And why did Murgor blow his whistle? The argument by the Kalenjins was very simple. Before this land was taken by the white settlers, it belonged to somebody, or somebody had a claim to it, mythical or real, but they did. Now that independence comes and somebody else comes from another province and settles here, what is our entitlement? That question was never addressed. That is the Christian who is coming back to haunt us today. Because if you go to Eldred and somebody says, that land which used to belong to Mr. Jones, at independence, Kenyatta came and settled these people, it is us who should have been settled here, you must address that question, mythical or real. Yes, Mr. Land.
David, through a comment on Peter's observation and then a question. The problem of land in the Rift Valley, I think, is almost impossible to resolve. Because if you take the eastern half of the Rift Valley, the area that in the colonial era was the dairy farming, beef farming area, the squatter labor or sharecroppers on those farms was overwhelmingly Kikuyu.
Mm-hmm.
And it was overwhelmingly Kikuyu really from the first decade of the 20th century. By 1914, you already had large-scale Kikuyu settlement from outside those areas. By 1920, one in three Kikuyu did not live in Central Province but lived on European farms in the Rift Valley. So it's not an issue that was created by Kenyatta, I fear. It's not as simple as that. It's a question that these people have actually been on that land now for a century, and they simply cannot be rolled back into Central Province. My question is on the Constitution. The Constitution issue has dominated Kenyan politics now for a decade. Well, political reform in the 1980s, 1990s, but the Constitution per se, I would say since 1997. All right, we can argue about it. But my fundamental problem is that you had this Constitutional Review Commission, you had this big inquiry, you had Yash Guy and his colleagues doing their stuff. And they produced what was a totally unworkable constitution. And it seems to me that nobody in Kenya is really concerned about the constitution. If you look at the voting in the referendum, it wasn't about constitutional reform, it was about ethnic coalitions. When are you Kenyans actually going to grapple with creating a workable constitution instead of the pie-in-the-sky rubbish donated to you by Guy?
Let me deal with this guy.
They're not unknown to each other.
You know, the problem is David Troop. He has formed ideas in his head, and he wants to impose those ideas on Kenyans. It doesn't work. It doesn't. You see, for those of us who have been involved in this constitutional process, we know it's a struggle. And the bombers of Kenya is not something that Guy imposed on people. No. It wasn't. Guy didn't impose it. Guy didn't. No, not even Arap Moi. It's the bombers of Kenya. If anything, this constitutional process in Kenya is perhaps one of the most consultative processes. It started, by the way, David, with the Saitoti's group in KANU. You know, the march towards the 91-92 reform, Section 2A was not just removed overnight. It was preceded by the Saitoti Commission set up by Moi, going around the country and hearing the views of the people. And if you remember, Kenyans expressed tremendous views of what kind of constitution they want. And these debates were in the papers, in civil society organizations with it, and they did write a report. When they went to Kasarani, their report was Kenyans don't want a multi-party state, they want a one-party state. But Moi had been listening to what people were saying, and Moi overruled them. I said, no, we might change Section 2A of the Constitution. That was not a make-believe process. It was a real process. And from then on, we went to Parliament, we were elected to Parliament, and we started struggles for a new constitution. In debates in Parliament, After all, why do you think that the Combo Select Committee was established to look into the economic crimes and anti-corruption, and was in that committee, secret to it? Some of the issues we had to deal with are constitutional issues. So I don't think we are going to listen to David Throop's ideas, which are contrary to actually political practice in Kenya. Oh, I don't care. So, secondly, you remember David Throop, I said, when these people say that this land was mythical or real, because one of the things you have to know about land issues in Kenya, for example, we the Luos believe that somebody called Ramogi captured land for us, and that Luanda Magere chased the Kalenjins from some land. And that can go to a case court. I followed a case court when I was at Makerere of this thing like this, where land claims can be mythical or real, and then they become parts of political struggles. You see, but you, I don't know.
All right, this has provoked a host of hands. Unfortunately, we're going to have to bring this to a close, so there are going to be two more questions. Before I pick two at random, I want to announce that Professor Onyango has agreed to stay on for a few minutes up on the fourth floor to meet with any media that are here. I believe there are a couple of representatives from East African papers, so that'll proceed there immediately after the close. All right, it's going to have to be random. I'm going to take one here, and I guess with deference on the right, and a lady will have three.
Tony Barclay from DAI. We haven't yet heard this morning about the fate of the people in the camps. And I wonder what the coalition government can do, and what ODM in particular can do, to rise above the performance of the United States government with Katrina. Because in many ways, with the tens of thousands of people in limbo, are they hostages to the constitutional process, or is something that the government can do in the near term?
Okay, and over here in the center.
Yes, Cosma Atere from the World Bank. Mr. Minister, I'd just like if you could confirm for us, clarify one particular issue. And this is, I think, an issue that has been very emotive during the campaign and is, I think, grossly misunderstood by Kenyans. It's the whole question of federalism or Majimbo. And, you know, there have been, you know, really back and forth on this. Could you just clarify what is your role, what is your vision? And I think this was a key concern and a claim for ODM. People are talking about devolution and so on. Please clarify exactly what you mean by this.
Yeah, thank you. Excellent question. And finally?
I'm Mary Mulusa. I'm from the World Bank. I'm a Kenyan. What one thing this electoral experience did was surface a lot of underlying concerns in Kenya. And one of them, of course, is the ethnic issue. And looking at what the way everything has played out, and I must confess, even amongst ourselves, peers and friends, Kenyans, we were having this uncomfortable discussion, and in most cases, it ceased quietly because we did not want to confront certain issues. And of course, underlying this, you've mentioned a couple of them. I think after the last election, the coalition, and once more, it got out of power, we were hopeful that we were getting into a new era where there would be greater equity in the distribution of resources, in the distribution of some obvious things, offices and so on. We didn't see that. When we see a delegation come here, it doesn't look like a Kenyan delegation. So moving ahead, looking into the future, what needs to happen? What kind of conversation needs to be there so that we get a sense that Kenya can continue forward viable as one nation? Or should we begin to think that maybe there is the differences are such that we are not viable as one nation? We see polarization. We see one community or group of communities come together and the others kind of coalesce around together. And so there is us and them. Do we really see a hope?
That's a very good question. Mary, nationhood and ethnicity or communal identity are not mutually exclusive, although they can be competitive. And the process of nation building is really a process of bringing these two together, recognizing and accepting ethnic identities, and also putting in motion a process of nationhood, which is a process. Now, the independent constitution, when I look at it, was very good at dealing with individual rights, very silent on communal or people's rights. And the Majimbo constitution, the regional constitution, responded to these certain concerns of people's rights by saying every region would have its own government and local affairs and so on. At that point in time, the regions were identified with provinces, generally. I'm not quite sure that is the correct way of identifying communal rights myself, or people's rights. What Bomas Kenya tried to do was to look at the ethnic and geographical configuration of Kenya very carefully and saying, if you are going to deal with people's rights, into how many regions can you divide Kenya? For example, the Rift Valley. You can't treat the Rift Valley just as one region. How many regions? Looking at the communal and people's rights, cultural issues and so on, can you divide the Rift Valley, Nyanza, Central Province and so on? And I think we came up with about 14 regions, if I don't, not quite. And you see, if you then say that the idea of recognizing people's rights does not necessarily need to be in conflict with nationhood, then you will begin to identify and deal with the ethnic issue. Because we should not be afraid or ashamed or guilty about ethnicity. If anything, it is what forms the cultural diversity, the mosaic of the Kenyan nation. But we should give it an expression such that it doesn't become a point for political exclusion. When the ODM talks about political inclusion, we also take the issue of devolution of power and factoring in people's rights in the new constitution. So the new constitution, a very important document, David Throop. It addresses these very fundamental issues.
Yeah, that's why it's important to get it right. Yeah.
Yeah, but we are trying to get it right. You. Anyway, forget about David Throop. So if we are going to address the underlying ethnic concerns, that is our point of departure. Both from the point of view of really looking at these things sociologically, but also addressing the germane political issues. And that leads me to the issue of federalism, Majimbo. You see, the word Majimbo has a historical baggage. It's a historical baggage because it formed part of the struggles of the 60s over the Majimbo Constitution. I remember I was a student at Lawrence High School in 1963 when Kibaki, then Parliamentary Secretary, the Minister of Planning, and Namboya came to talk to us. And we asked him that same question, what are you going to do with the Majimbo Constitution? And he told us very clearly, we shall break it. And I remember that to this very day. And they broke it. The way in which they dealt with what they called the ethnic question was to centralize politics in the service of nationhood and at the expense of people's rights. And this is something that we'd like to deal with and not deal with the way the people like Kibaki dealt with in the 60s. You must recognize and factor in the process of nation building the issue of people's rights.
I want to push you on this because it's so crucial, particularly the either lack of or potential of a constituency for a different form of devolution, such as you've been talking about, within Central Province, because there are some divisions here, I think generationally or not. That is to say, cooler heads within Central Province realizing that, in fact, such devolutions will serve their interests as well over the long term.
Sure.
Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, because if you let me take a very good example. When we introduce Constituency Development Fund, all of a sudden, people realized that this thing called the DDC, District Development Committee, had done nothing for 20 years. That with about 30 million shillings, people can see dispensaries, schools, desks, books, cattle dips, whatnot, being built. Because funds have been devolved to the constituency. Because we are now dealing with issues of management and so on. But another example, somebody sitting in Nairobi in the Ministry of Health, how really are they going to know that a dispensary somewhere in Rata, my village, does not have a toilet? The reporting system is such that by the time the fellow knows, the compound is full of shit. But if the dispensary was the responsibility of a devolved system of government, such that somebody to whom taxes are paid and is accountable can easily access and know what's happening, services can be delivered better at the grassroots. Secondly, why should the police commissioner in Nairobi be the one in charge of a police station in Maseno and begin moving officers here and there in Maseno? Why can't it be somebody in Hulu? Why should policing be a central government issue? Why should security in general in a locality be always a central government issue? Can't it be a community issue? When you talk about community policing, and is a community policing organized from Nairobi, not from a local. So there are all these issues of governance which I think are addressed by devolution. And in the Bomas of Kenya, there was a very lively debate for days. What are going to be the responsibilities of devolved system of government? And what are the responsibilities going to be retained by the central government? And I remember, if I remember well, Federalist Paper number 10, written by Madison, talking about these things and issues of factions and so on. When it comes to deciding what goes to the states. I mean, these things are germane to all societies, David Throop. Yeah. IDPs. Okay.
Do not forget
IDPs.
Tony Barclay.
Yeah, internally displaced persons. Are they going to be hostages to the constitutional process? No. Because what we did, one of the things we did even before the government was formed, but once the accord was signed, is that we chose a committee chaired by me and David and Professor George Saitoti to deal with the emergency issues. And one of the things that we were dealing with was to do the IDPs. And I wish I'd brought that document, but I hope they will download it. What we were proposing was the following. And Saitoti and myself differed over this issue, but I can share it with you. Saitoti said, look, IDPs must go back to where they came from. I said, how, Professor? There is insecurity there. We shall build police stations. Yes, you build police stations, but how will they farm? The police will escort them to the farms during the day. They will farm and come back to the police station the next day. It can't happen that way because you are just setting yourself for more conflict. I think that the way we are going to deal... By the way, a lot of IDPs from Central Province, we evacuated 50,000 people from Central Province, Luos and Luyas and a few colonies from Central Province. And a lot of them who went to temporary IDP camps in Kisumu have all now been settled. Why? Because they were absorbed into family structures, people went back to their original homes, and culturally, in Luo society, when somebody who left you 20, 30, 40 years ago and he can trace where his grandmother was buried, you give him land there. Culturally acceptable. It may not be very big land, but at least not IDPs. And the thing now to do is, how do you deal with their compensating them and giving them better livelihood? But at least they have homes. They are not sitting in camps. So 50,000 IDPs from Central Province at least have homes. But the others who are in these IDP camps must be dealt with. The way you deal with them is not to forcefully take them back to where they came from, because that is another sort of conflict you are setting up. What we must do is and they don't want to go back, by the way. They've said so. Quite a number of them said they don't want to go back. But find some resources for them. Give them gainful life somewhere, which is commensurate with what they had before, even better.
and make sure that the way you settle them this time does not create a source of conflict in your future. It is not something that should be done hurriedly, as if you don't do them, the heaven will come down. But it should be done in such a way that it deals with the source of the problem. And I think this is what we recommended in our committee. And so the first thing we are going to do, we said, once the government is formed, leaders should go out to these areas and talk to communities to start a process of reconciliation, to adjust ourselves to the sins we committed yesterday and go under the cross and confess them. As a good Catholic, that true peace, that should be done. And I think that process of reconciliation that is put in the paper that we did in that committee is going to help. I'm not saying it's going to be easy, but at least we have put in motion a process that will, we hope, in the final analysis, deal with the IDP issue.